So our Bible reading tonight comes in two parts. First we go to chapter 1, and then I'll continue in a part of chapter 4. It's all there in front of us. The Lord called Moses and spoke to him from the tent of meeting, saying, "Speak to the people of Israel and say to them, when any one of you brings an offering to the Lord, you shall bring your offering of livestock from the herd or from the flock. If his offering is a burnt offering from the herd, he shall offer a male without blemish. He shall bring it to the entrance of the tent of meeting, that he may be accepted before the Lord. He shall lay his hand on the head of the burnt offering, and it shall be accepted for him to make atonement for him. Then he shall kill the bull before the Lord. And Aaron's sons, the priests, shall bring the blood and throw the blood against the sides of the altar that is at the entrance of the tent of meeting. Then he shall flay the burnt offering and cut it into pieces. And the sons of Aaron, the priests, shall put fire on the altar and arrange wood on the fire. And Aaron's sons, the priests, shall arrange the pieces, the head and the fat on the wood that is on the fire on the altar. But its entrails and its legs he shall wash with water, and the priest shall burn all of it on the altar as a burnt offering, a food offering with a pleasing aroma to the Lord." Chapter 4, verse 27. "If anyone of the common people sins unintentionally by doing any one of the things that by the Lord's commandments ought not to be done, and realizes his guilt, or the sin which he has committed is made known to him, he shall bring his offering, a goat, a female without blemish, for his sin which he has committed. And he shall lay his hand on the head of the sin offering and kill the sin offering in the place of the burnt offering. And the priest shall take some of its blood with his finger and put it on the horns of the altar of the burnt offering and pour out all the rest of its blood at the base of the altar. And all its fat he shall remove. As the fat is removed from the peace offerings, and the priest shall burn it on the altar for a pleasing aroma to the Lord. And the priest shall make atonement for him, and he shall be forgiven."
Book of James in the New Testament has two of the most fantastic promises in the Bible. One is in chapter 4, verse 7. "Resist the devil and he will flee from you." And that is fantastic. But the other big promise in James is even bigger and better. It's in the very next sentence, James 4, 8. "Draw near to God and he will draw near to you." Now, isn't that one wonderful? And it's such a great invitation. Draw near to God. Come to him. Come up close. And especially after the bit about fleeing the fleeing devil, it sounds warm and protective and as embracing and as comforting as ever you could want. And it goes with everything we learn from the New Testament about how through Jesus we can have God as our Father and we can call him Father on the most intimate terms. And it fits with what David says in the Psalms about God knowing us intimately when he formed us in the womb, or what Jesus says in the New Testament about God knowing the number of our hairs. Or the story that Jesus tells about the Father running out to embrace the Son who comes home. And we think, do I want to draw near God and have him draw near me? Of course I do. How I'm going to experience it and what it might mean, what sense I will have of drawing near to God, is something I have to find out. But the idea and the promise, that is just great. But then the problem. See, in the New Testament, and notice we haven't even gone to the Old Testament to find this out. In the New Testament, we find in the New Testament book of Hebrews, our God is a consuming fire. Or the bit in Hebrews chapter 10 where it says, it's a fearful thing to fall into the hands of the living God. There's this huge idea that God can be good and loving and kind and terrifying at the same time. Think of that bit really early on in the gospel story when Peter meets Jesus back in when Peter is still in his fishing days. And we get the story in Luke chapter 5. Luke writes, "On one occasion, when the crowd was pressing in around Jesus to hear the word of God, he was standing by the lake of Gennesaret, and he saw two boats by the lake. But the fishermen had gone out of them and were washing their nets. Getting into one of the boats, which was Simon's, he asked him to put out a little from the land. And he sat down and taught the people from the boat. And when he finished speaking, he said to Simon, 'Put out into the deep and let down your nets for a catch.' And Simon answered, 'Master, we've toiled all night and took nothing, but at your word, I will let down the nets.' And when they'd done this, they enclosed a large number of fish, and their nets were breaking. They signaled to their partners in the other boat to come and help them. And they came and filled both boats so that they began to sink. But when Simon Peter saw it, he fell down at Jesus' knees, saying, 'Depart from me, for I am a sinful man, O Lord.'" Now, can we get just a sense of what's going on for Peter there? It's not just that Jesus is powerful or magical or something. Everything that Jesus has done in that story is good from Peter's point of view. He hasn't made any kind of threat against Peter. Peter is only going to benefit from selling massive numbers of fish. But Peter gets just a glimpse of who he's dealing with, and Peter realizes that Jesus is somehow God himself. "Depart from me, for I am a sinful man, O Lord." He realizes he is somehow in the presence of God himself, and he is not worthy. Peter's got the problem, like I've got the problem, like you've got the problem. I know where the dark shadows are inside me. I know where I don't measure up. I know the things I'm ashamed of. So if our God is a consuming fire, I am right there with Peter. "Depart from me, for I am a sinful man, O Lord." And James saying, "Draw near to God," is going to be a bit of a problem, isn't it? So what's the answer? Does the Bible give us any help in dealing with our consuming fire problem? Now, this is where this astonishing and wonderful Old Testament book of Leviticus comes in to help us. Now, I know we say these are the Old Testament laws, and the Old Testament laws have all been fulfilled for us by Jesus, so these are not our laws, and we don't need to keep them, and all that. But if these laws are all fulfilled by Jesus, then these are part of the great big package that Jesus has handed over to us, complete and done for all time by him. And we can get great benefit by unwrapping that package and looking in at what he has done and completed. And the more we understand this, the more we understand Jesus, and the more we understand what it is for us to live for him. But we too have two big hurdles to watch out for in understanding what God is saying in this part of Leviticus. One hurdle is really easy to jump, and the other hurdle is a bit trickier. The easy hurdle is this. These are words from another time and place and another culture and another way of doing things that are really not our ways of doing things. Now, fair enough. So think about that time and place and culture. As we read this, think like an Israelite. Look at these things through Old Testament Israelite eyes. Understand these things in their time and place. Now, that is not too hard to do. We've got an Old Testament to help us get our heads into that zone. The other bigger hurdle is language. Our English language is really mixed up on this stuff. And because of all kinds of things in religion and history, the words that we use for the things in these chapters have become hopelessly tangled up. So we have to be careful. And all the way through, we need to pay attention to what's going on. And we really have to be careful not to just think that because we use words in certain ways, that's the way that the Israelites are understanding the same words in Leviticus. And we hit that hurdle right here in the second verse in an important way. I mean, you can see what Moses is supposed to say to the Israelites, can't you? Verse 2, speak to the people of Israel and say to them, when any one of you brings an offering to the Lord, and with the English word offering, straight away, we're in trouble. Because our culture and our language and our heads and the way that we think about these things is shaped by all the temples and gods of the world outside ancient Israel, full of gods and offerings and sacrifices. And to us, in ordinary English like we use nowadays, in ordinary English, what's a sacrifice? In this country, a superannuation sacrifice is a bit of your wages that you reroute, don't you? And you have it channeled through into your super. When we give up stuff so that we can do a course or something, we talk about the sacrifices we make so that we can finish that wretched degree. Being sacrificial for us is going without something, isn't it? Like in chemistry, you can have, or on a boat, you can have a sacrificial anode that you expect to get eaten away by the chemicals or eaten away by the seawater on a boat. In building, you can have sacrificial render on the outside of a building that you expect to be eaten away by what's coming out of the soil. And offerings have the same flavour. Something of yours that you bring and hand over, you offer, you give up, you generously go without. And all round the world and all through history, that's what sacrifices are like. You offer them over to the God, and you go without them. And that shows the God something, doesn't it? And often there is the idea that the God gets a kind of benefit from what you offer. In the culture that old Abraham came, it worked quite literally like that. We can read about it in their books from the time of Abraham. There was the idea that the gods were hungry. So you sacrificed an animal to them, and that would give the gods something to eat. So the gods got the benefit and they felt rather happy about you. And depending on the gods, they might feel so happy that they give you something that you want, like a wife or a husband or a baby or a job or a cure for your headaches or safety from your enemies or whatever it is. Now, most people since Abraham have been a bit more sophisticated than that. But you offer up an animal or fruit or flowers or money to the gods, and they are pleased with you for giving up something valuable. They do something nice for you. And we know because it is our landscape. Temples and shrines and holy places all around us. They're always filled with flowers and fruit and good things that have been handed over as offerings to the gods. Usually in the hope that the gods will return some kind of benefit. But here in Leviticus, none of those ideas are on the horizon. The idea of giving something of yours up is not the big picture. Offering something to God that he will benefit from, that is not in the picture. God getting something to eat is nowhere in the picture. God giving you a blessing in exchange for your offering is not in the picture. So what is? In the middle of Leviticus, we've got God saying in chapter 19, "I, the Lord your God, am holy." And in Leviticus, the Israelites are in the position of Peter in that boat full of fish. If God is holy, if God is good, if God is pure and good and holy, how can you possibly come anywhere near him and still live? But James gets there early in James chapter 1, because the word translated here as offering is better translated as drawing near. The Hebrew language, the way that Hebrew language works is it loves playing with its verbs. It names things after what they do. I don't know for sure, but I understand that Arabic works pretty much the same way. So in the Hebrew language, birds are called flyers because it's what they do. Mice are called creepers. Grasshoppers are called jumpers and chompers and devourers and eaters. The thing that you bring with you in verse 2 is named for what it does. So the thing that you bring with you in verse 2 is a drawing near. So in verse 2, when you're an Israelite and you come to approach the Lord, you bring with you your drawing near thing. And even the approach to the Lord has a very clear sense for you as an Israelite. This is Leviticus. It comes after Exodus. The Israelites are at Mount Sinai and they have just constructed a great tent in the middle of their campsite that acts like a throne room for God himself. In verse 1, it's called the tent of meeting. But for you as an Israelite, to draw near to God, to approach God himself, has a very physical sense of coming along to this tent of meeting. You meet God there. But he is holy, and he's good, and he is light, and in him there is no darkness. He is a consuming fire, and as an Israelite, you know that. So, how are you going to approach him? Now, as Leviticus goes on, we looked at it in all those chapters just now. We see that there are different kinds of drawing near things that you can bring with you, and which one you bring depends on your circumstances. But this time, in verse 3, your drawing near thing is a burnt offering. Now watch the words again, because in burnt offering, the word offering still is not really there. The Hebrew language plays with its verbs again, and each different kind of drawing near thing gets a name from the circumstances. And the name for this one in verse 3 is a going up. And you can even tell why in verse 9. Most of it is going to go up in smoke. This one is the most basic kind of drawing near thing. So you draw near with your animal for the going up, And in verse 5, it's a bull. And it really has to be a bull in good condition in verse 3. You're not going to bring your old animal with the mange and two bad legs at its back end or something for an important thing like this. But in verse 3, you bring this good animal up to the entrance of the tent. The place at the entrance where you do this is the great bronze altar in the courtyard of the tent. It's like a huge bronze barbecue. And in verse 4, you lay your hand on the animal's head. Now, why are you doing that? In the Old Testament laws, when you lay your hands on someone or on something, it's a way of identifying with them. And in this case, standing in front of the tent with your prize animal, you're saying, this animal is me. In what is about to happen, this animal stands for me. And then this animal that you've just identified with in verse 5, you kill it. You cut its throat. Then in verse 5, for the first time, the Israelite priest steps in. He collects up your animal's blood and he splashes it around the bronze altar. And in verse 6, he skins the animal and cuts it into pieces. And with different kinds of drawing near things in the next few chapters, different things happen to the pieces of animals. But this one is the simplest. The priest piles wood onto the altar, and except for the skin, in verse 8, everything gets put onto the altar. And in verse 9, the priest burns it there in front of you, so your going up thing goes up. Now, two things to watch out for. The pleasing aroma is the massive barbecue smell as your animal burns in front of you. And when you think about it, that would be an overwhelming experience standing there, wouldn't it? The meat cooking smell, or the meat overcooking smell going up in front of you. And the way our translation has the other bit in verse 9 doesn't quite help. A food offering, when it says a food offering here, it makes it feel like we're back in the days of helping God out by offering him a nice meal. You know, we've offered him some food. How good of us. I really do not know why our translators have done that. Other versions, other translations of the Bible get it better. The word that they use has nothing to do with food and nothing to do with offering something. The word is to do with fire. So verse 9 is saying it's a fiery thing that is making a pleasing smell, which makes sense of what is happening right in front of you. And what's the point of doing this as an Israelite? Bringing your animal to help you draw near, cutting its throat, burning its flesh, splashing its blood. What is it for? Verse 4. It shall be accepted for him to make atonement for him. And that's the big bit. The thing that's happened in a pile of symbols has dealt with our Peter in the fishing boat problem. Depart from me, for I am a sinful man, O Lord. Or our Hebrews problem. Our God is a consuming fire. You draw near. You identify that closely with your animal, and all that lands on the animal instead of on you. Everything that belongs to you is deflected to the animal. And your drawing near thing makes atonement so that you can draw near. with these ancient Israelite symbols, you can come into the presence of God and still be alive. And if you still want to call it sacrifice, you can see what kind of sacrifice it is. It's not something where you are giving it up and God is getting some kind of benefit out of it. It is more like your superannuation, where you set money aside, but providing the market doesn't crash in the meantime, you eventually get the benefit of it. So you're not giving it to someone else, you are getting the benefit. In the Israelite tent of meeting, the benefit of the animal dying is yours. It makes atonement for you. And you can draw near and pray and rejoice and pour your heart out to God and live your life close up with God, knowing that you are His person and He has accepted you. It's a brilliant and powerful set of symbols, isn't it? And Leviticus takes it further. So when we read all those other chapters, there's a series of different kinds of drawing near things to cover different reasons for wanting to draw near to God. So, for example, the one that we've got here in chapter 4. And it gets explained there in verse 27. If any one of the common people sins unintentionally in doing any one of the things that by the Lord's commandments ought not to be done, and realizes his guilt or the sin which he has committed is made known to him. So this one is for those moments when you realize, oh dear, I've done the wrong thing. Ever had that experience? Oh dear, I've done the wrong thing. Have you ever managed to get through a whole day when you don't have that experience? Now we find out in chapter 6 that if I have hurt another person by what I've done, I've got to put things right with that person as well. I'm not allowed to imagine that just going through a procedure at the tent of meeting is somehow going to get me off the hook while my friend is still hurt by what I've done. But this bit in chapter 4, I want to fix things between me and God as well. And Leviticus, if I'm an Israelite, Leviticus gives me away. And this time in verse 28, the drawing near thing is a female goat. What I do with it is very similar. In verse 29, I lay my hands on it. I identify myself with this animal. Then I kill it. Verse 30, the priest deals with the blood. And in verse 31, parts of it are burned on the altar. In verse 31, atonement is made. And then I get to hear those glorious words at the end of verse 31. The words that I am aching to hear in my guilt, he shall be forgiven. I'm free. I'm pardoned. I'm in the clear. I can breathe again. And this time there's that really interesting bit in verse 29. See what name this drawing near thing has. The one back in chapter 1 was called a going up. But what's this one called? Verse 29, a sin offering. Although, again, the word offering isn't there. In verse 29, the goat is called a sin. Just that. Same word as in verse 28 to describe the thing that I did. Back in chapter 1, that animal stood in for me and it got what was coming to me. But this time, there's something more specific. It's like, when I lay my hands on that goat and I identify with it, symbolically my sin is kind of downloaded onto the goat and it becomes the sin that I am worried about. And I kill it. And I can safely draw near to God and hear those words of forgiveness. They are crude and brutal, these ancient symbols, aren't they? But can you see how powerful the experience would be for you as an Israelite, there with your livestock, seeing it die instead of you? Now, we know these things were only ever symbols, and when they were thinking straight, the Israelites knew that they were only ever symbols. So we get King David in the Psalms saying, "Deliver me from blood guiltiness, O God. You will not delight in sacrifice, or I would bring it. You will not be pleased with a burnt offering. The sacrifices acceptable to God are a broken spirit. A broken and contrite heart, O God, you will not despise." And David knows that the real thing of a changed human life is more important in front of God than the symbols. And by the time we get to the New Testament, the book of Hebrews says, it is impossible for the blood of bulls and goats to take away sins. We know that, and the Israelites knew that. But for a bit more than 1,000 years, the Israelites had these very powerful symbols, and the idea was there embedded into it all the time. If I'm going to draw near a holy God and live, something has to die in my place. Year after year after year, every time you draw near to God in his tent of meeting and later in the temple, something has to die in your place. Until we get to the New Testament, and what do we find? Jesus appears, and what does John the Baptist say? "Behold, the Lamb of God who takes away the sin of the world." And what does Peter say? "You were ransomed with the precious blood of Christ, like that of a lamb, without blemish or spot." Or Hebrews, talking about Jesus, "He has no need, like those high priests who offer sacrifices daily for his own sins and then for those of the people, since he did this once for all when he offered up himself." There are big, obvious places like that all over the New Testament where Jesus has done in reality what the Old Testament did with symbols. Jesus' death on the cross is the big thing that does everything that the old sacrifices stood for. And with over 1,000 years of the old sacrifices, the ground is there to understand what Jesus' death means. But once we see it in the obvious places, it's there in the background of the less obvious places. So when we get Paul in Romans saying, "Christ Jesus, whom God put forward as a propitiation by his blood to be received by faith." That funny little Latin word, propitiation, a sacrifice that turns aside the wrath of an angry God. It's picking up the same language as we saw in Leviticus about making atonement. Jesus has done the Leviticus 1 sacrifice so that we can draw near to God. Or how about this one from 2 Corinthians 5? "God made him to be sin who knew no sin, so that in him we might become the righteousness of God." That idea of something becoming sin so that we could be forgiven, that's the goat in Leviticus 4 that becomes a sin. The same as Jesus. The judgment lands on the goat. The judgment lands on Jesus. These things we read about in symbols in Leviticus, these are the things that God has done for us in reality in Jesus. And that's got a massive effect for us. God is still holy. He hasn't changed. He is still pure and good. He is still light where there is no darkness at all. He is still a consuming fire.
But Jesus has taken on the role of the bulls and goats of Leviticus in reality. The consuming fire has landed on him so that it doesn't land on us. And with Jesus, when James says, draw near to God, we can, in safety and hope. And those great words from verse 31 down there belong to us. We know what it is to be forgiven. Draw near to God, and he will draw near to you. With Jesus, the promise stands. Draw near to God, and he will draw near to you. And we can live to tell the tale. With Jesus, all this, all that the Israelites had in big, clunky symbols, all this is ours in reality. And with Jesus, our whole life gets to be life near God. And that is just brilliant.